Welcome to Showbiz Atlanta. It is Wednesday, March 21st. I'm your host, Dana Barrett, and I am joined today in the studio by Kirk Sarkisian. Did I say it right?
You did.
All right. Kirk is, I'm going to let him do most of his own intro because it's really long, but basically he is in name only, well, sort of chairman of the board of Disc Revolt, which if you're a musician, you probably already know what that is. Also a Hall of Fame drummer, all around nice guy. He's nodding his head at that, maybe, maybe kind of.
I want to meet this guy.
Yeah, me too. Where is he? So he's here today for a couple of reasons. One, because, hey, this is Showbiz Atlanta, and he kind of knows the business a little bit.
Yeah, showbiz is my life.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about that. But also because he is part of doing some giving back, which we always like to hear about in this industry. And lots of it goes on, but sometimes it's sort of... you know, nobody really, sometimes people use it to talk about it a lot, but a lot of times it's behind the scenes. And he's doing some work with Wellspring, which is a local charity here, and they've got a golf tournament coming up. So we're going to get to all of that.
Plug the tournament.
Yeah, we're going to get to all of that. So before we do all that, I want to talk about you. So tell me a little bit about your background in music. How did you always know you wanted to be a drummer? When did this start for you? We're going way back.
Yeah, it does go way back. First of all, thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Yes.
I started playing drums at 13, and it was by accident. I went to a pep rally with my brother to his high school.
Okay.
And it was very exciting. You know, I was going with my older brother to his pep rally, and I was watching the band, and the guy who was having the best time was the drummer. And that's where I noticed drums.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, just my mother would probably tell you I was beating stuff around the house forever, but... that's when I really first noticed being a drummer. And it was shortly after that that I started really working towards it. I wanted to play piano. My parents were starting a business, couldn't afford the piano.
Yeah, that's an expensive one.
Yeah, and some very shrewd salesman said to my father, well, you know, a piano is a percussion instrument. So why don't you take him this cymbal and snare drum home and he can start on that.
Wow.
And my dad thought it would be something. So he brought it home, and my mother immediately said that can't stay in the house.
Yeah, I don't blame her.
No. And so so they found a place for me to practice and play. Played in high school. I made my first wage when I was 13.
Really?
Yeah. There was a group of guys. We got together and formed a band and went to an American Legion Hall on a Friday fish fry night.
Oh, my God.
And set up and played and had a donation bucket. And we made $68 between the four of us.
Wow.
And we thought that was it.
Well, at 13?
At 13.
It was fun, and it was more than you'd make at a lemonade stand.
That's true. And so we had fish quite a bit for that whole summer.
That's great.
Back week after week.
I'll bet.
And that's really how the whole thing started. I mean, I tell people all the time, or those people that ask, you know, how did you get to this point? How did you get so good? You know, and that's subjective.
Right.
I mean,
obviously you got to a certain point in your career.
Yes. I mean, I'm blessed to have gotten this far. And if you ask me how I did it, it would be very difficult for me to say, well, I put my mind to doing this and I worked, you know, A, B, C, and D, and this is what happened. Because it's just, you know, I ended up having some natural talent, and I think that goes a long way. And then I had the desire to take that talent and do something with it.
And so did you do formal training besides, like, lessons?
Well, the only lessons we took, and I grew up in Chicago, but we moved to Northwest Indiana right about the time I was finishing middle school, going into high school. And the music department there wasn't a very sophisticated music department. The drummers were given sticks and told to stand at the back of the room and not play unless they were told to play.
Okay.
And then only what they were told to play.
Very creative.
So that was formal training. But I studied with a friend of mine, and we got off on our own and then started doing rudimentary drumming, which is, you know, rudiments are like a drummer's language.
Okay.
And there are contests, state contests for rudimentary drumming. And we went to the state and took first and second on two pieces. I took first as a solo drummer that year, and then repeated it the second year. So we weren't actually given formal training. We just sort of took it upon ourselves to start playing this way.
Gotcha.
It wasn't until I got to college. I went to Indiana University. that I started monitoring a lot of their jazz improvisation classes. I wasn't in the Jacobs School of Music.
Okay.
You had to be a very studied musician and do auditions. And I, you know, I was a rock and roll drummer just pounding as hard as I could.
Yeah.
So it really wasn't for me. But I have a strong urge to sit with anyone who could play an instrument and talk to them about how they do what they do. And I'm in awe of so many of the people I've played with for years.
So it's still kind of your passion.
It is.
Yeah.
I don't think it ever goes away. I jokingly say I've tried to retire a couple times, but it's just
not
if
happening.
I'm retired, I'm still playing drums because I have a couple sets set up in the house and
yeah.
I get to go down and my office is in our lower level, and if I pass by the studio going
it
to the office,
to you.
I sit and play for a while. Yeah. I go do some work. I come back out on the way back up. I sit and play for a while.
That's awesome.
But over the years, I've been called to do some work where a band I was in did their 30th reunion, did a couple sellout shows in St. Louis.
And what band would that be?
It was a group called Pavlov's Dog.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's a conditioned response, which all music is.
Nice. You know? Hey, it makes sense.
It does make sense. We've been asked so many times, well, which one of you guys is Pavlov?
Oh.
Yeah, that was a joke. We did a 10-year and a 30-year, and in fact, the band still plays on in some form or another overseas. Very popular in Europe.
Okay.
In fact, that band, during its heyday, which is the middle 70s, was a top 5 concert draw in Concert News magazine.
Huh.
So my kids today will look at the books that I have with some clippings in it, and it'll say, I forgot who the 1 and 2 band is, but certainly Queen and Fleetwood Mac were past us.
Yeah.
So, and there's, they scratched their heads and said, how does that happen? How are you here now and not out there playing still?
Yeah.
But it's a fickle industry.
All right. I have to have a total sidetrack because I'm thinking about the 70s now.
Yeah.
Did you have like crazy long hairdo?
Oh, yeah.
You should see this guy right now. Very conservative looking gentleman sitting across the table from me.
And this is what happened.
I wish you had brought pictures. Darn.
I've got most of those hidden.
I bet.
The reason I have short hair is really one night at a concert, I'm playing, and sticks, they're wood, they break down because they're hitting a metal rim. They get soft. And you could tell when they're getting soft. I usually pitch them. But before this one was so soft that I threw it behind me and picked up another one, it started to fray.
Yeah.
And as I turned, my hair got caught.
Oh, my God.
So my next move was out in front of me towards a cymbal, and it took about a little less than a quarter-sized chunk of hair out of my head, and it hurt so bad.
Oh, that's yucky.
It hurts me to talk about it.
Yeah,
today.
It hurts me to hear it.
So
yeah, I feel pain.
Yeah, one of the things that occurs at concerts is that there are a lot of people backstage that cut hair.
Really?
Yeah. There are a number of people backstage that cut hair. So
they're ready to go.
There was a break, about a 5-minute break where I was off stage, and I walked backstage and I asked, who cuts hair? And probably 4 or 5 pairs of scissors came up. And I grabbed the first person. I said, I want it all off before I go back out. And I had him cut it all off, and I haven't had it long since.
What year was that?
That was 1977.
Wow. So you made it through the bulk of the 70s.
Yeah.
Sporting the long hair.
Oh, yeah. And it was long. My hair was really curly.
Yeah.
Probably about mid-chest and lower back.
So you had that classic 70s rocker thing going.
I had the big hair.
Nice.
Yeah.
I really, really wish you had brought pictures of that. So this is the kind of interview we're going to do today,
great.
So you know.
Dig up the past.
That's right. Yeah, totally. So tell me about some of the other bands you played with. And you were talking a little bit about being in like a studio musician and that doesn't really exist anymore. And I don't know much about that. So
yeah, it does exist in different configurations. Studio musicians were hired by studios back in the 70s, 60s, 50s, and before that, actually. They'd have a stable of guys that they would call. They'd be hired. They would go in and play. And you didn't know what you were going to play. You get to it'd be a job. You'd walk in, you get a call sheet. You'd have, in some cases, maybe 20 or 30 short sessions from playing a woodblock and triangle to actually playing maybe a 3-minute piece. You just never knew.
Yeah.
What it was for, whether it was for a tag for radio or television, or whether it was actually a piece that's going to be in part of the filming. You just didn't know.
Okay.
And I did that. I was under contract for a number of years. I jokingly say that I was the last guy who got picked for that group because some musicians that came out of that group of musicians are unbelievable drummers today.
Wow.
And so I got a lot of the jobs that they wouldn't take because they didn't want to travel.
Yeah.
But that led me to other cities where I got to play and people noticed me and asked me to play later. We chat about this before we came on air.
Right, right. Well, we have to share it with everybody else now. We can't be greedy.
Well, Dana has a stepbrother.
Yes.
Who plays drums.
Yes.
And we were talking about how many great drummers there are out there, and there's no shortage of great musicians. And they're absolutely everywhere. But the difference between those that may have an opportunity to make it and those that don't, are those that the ones that actually step out of their basements or their living rooms or their close group of friends and put themselves out there for whatever the market will say of them, whether they're good or bad. You know, but that's how you learn,
right?
And that's how you get better, and that's how you're seen by people who want to hire you.
And we were talking about that before we got on the air, and that's true across this business. I mean, that's true certainly for any talent, in you know, whether it's singer, actor, drummer, musician of any kind, dancer, whatever. You have to get out there. And the thing is, one of the things you said earlier actually plays right into this, because you said you had the personality, and I clearly still do, where anybody that was playing music, you wanted to sit down and talk to them and play with them and learn about their philosophies and what they were doing. And that's meeting people is half the battle.
And another part of that is that that's how you get your chops.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're talking to people about how they play and they get a chance to play with them.
Yeah.
You are cataloging the style that they're playing or the nuances that they have with their music, because there's nothing that's new. I mean, we all steal from everybody, you know, in your craft. You've learned from a book in the beginning, like how to play rudiments, to taking those rudiments and listening to guys who really do it for a living.
Yeah.
Perform. And so that was part of my education. In fact, it was most of my education playing.
Well, and you have to make that happen by asking and by talking about it.
Yeah, and here's the other part of it too. It was I always say that musicians are their own worst enemies. They will play for you for free.
Yeah.
You know, they don't know how to monetize themselves.
Right. A lot of creative people.
Basically all creative people are like that.
Writers, everybody, yeah.
And so you have to not care what people think. You have to be out there loving it just for loving it. It's not about – I mean, you want to make a living doing it. And my mother, who she's 85, was in business all her life. I always say I didn't get in it for the money. And she will find something to hit me with or kick me. She's close enough. She goes, don't say that. And I say, well, not – because it actually happened because I had a passion for it.
Right.
And I didn't let anything get in the way of that passion.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it'd be great if more people could do that. I think people would be happier in their lives, though, too.
Yeah, true.
Though, you know, money is nice.
It doesn't hurt.
It does not hurt. And so speaking of monetizing music, that's a perfect segue to talk about Disc Revolt a little bit. Because that is basically what you guys are doing, is trying to help artists that are up and coming to monetize what they're doing.
Right. I have Mike Sheamus is my partner, or I should say I'm his partner. And Mike came to me with an idea. We were sitting at a Starbucks, and he had a manila envelope, and he says, "Hey, I've got a business opportunity I want to talk to you about." Well, that's, you know, all of a sudden the hair stands up in the back of your head, and you're trying to figure out where the exits are.
Right, you're like holding onto your wallet for dear life.
Well, I knew Mike, and it wasn't quite like that, but it could have easily been like that. But he stands up, and he pours out probably around 50 room keys or cards, room cards. And I look at him and say, "Mike, I'm not that kind of guy." You know? And he says, no, you got to hear this. So Mike owns a recording studio, and actually he's had multiple award-winning acts out of that studio. It actually is in the basement of his house, and it's an amazing studio. But he said, I'm really getting tired of watching young people, young bands, good bands, come in and try to record their music and not have a budget really to support the type of work they need to have done. So they have to do what they can do and then walk away with something that they're going to have to go buy CDs at bulk price, because you can't make money unless you buy a large number of them. It's not so much like that anymore, but it was then.
Yeah.
And then carry around their inventory, which you know that they're not inventorying. When they're people are grabbing CDs and they just can't keep track of that stuff.
Right.
And at the end of the day, after the run of the songs, after people have heard them, whatever you're stuck with, you're stuck with.
Yeah.
You're basically giving it away anyway. So he said, let's take the concept of digital downloading and let's create an environment where independent artists could record their music and then store it on our server and then sell it to the fan at the live event when they're most engaged at whatever price the market will bear. And so the cards became a vehicle, a tactile transfer, because we knew if we did it just downloads, we couldn't just go from CD to download.
Yeah.
Too many people like liner notes. Too many people need to have something in their hands. I need to have something in my hands to this day.
Yeah.
You know, I really like looking and feeling and touching, you know, I would say album, but most people don't know what albums are. So.
Yeah.
The CD. And so Disc Revolt was born out of that idea, because truthfully, today, bands that go out and play clubs around Atlanta make less money than I made when I was learning how to play back in the 60s and 70s.
Really?
Less.
Ooh.
And when I was playing, drumsticks were under $1 for a pair.
Right.
Gas was like 25 cents.
Don't date yourself friend.
I'm proud of it. because my personal goal is to play drums one day longer than Charlie Watts, if that's possible. You know, but I played in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm getting close, I guess.
So drumsticks now cost what?
About $7 or $8.
So 7 times more than they did.
Yeah, and so today bands are making enough money to fill up their tank of gas and get a burrito to get to the next job.
Right.
You know, so by giving them something they can monetize, and the internet is a wonderful leveler of the playing field.
Right.
And the difference between popular bands, other than, I mean, obviously the substance of the music and the sound of the band is a big, big thing.
Sure.
But I've learned through the 6.5 years with Disc Revolt now that there are thousands of bands with unbelievable music that unfortunately will never be heard by the masses. And it's a shame.
Mm-hmm.
So we were looking for a way to give the young artist a way to do this. And we do that today. We've also taken Disc Revolt to another level. We were looking for other ways to help people out. So we currently are working with labeled acts to do their merchandising. And we do pre-sale releases and represent their, you know, their agencies and albums. And so is that word again?
Yeah. Yeah. Though it's funny that you say that, because another tangent here, but I was asking my daughter, because obviously for us it was albums, and then that went away and CDs came in. But now that CDs are almost kind of gone-ish, you know, you can still, I mean, still people buy CDs, but everything's so digital now. I said to my daughter, what do people call? Do they call them albums? Like, do you kids today call them albums? And she was like, yeah, we call them albums.
Yeah, they do call them.
They don't really, I mean, I think they all know what the albums were, because they all think vinyl's cool.
Well, vinyl's come back.
Right.
I mean, my kids have stacks of vinyl.
Yeah, which is sort of amazing.
And the funny thing is that they come in very excited by buying an old album.
Yeah.
And I go, you know, if you would have talked to me, I have it stored downstairs.
Yeah.
I have a lot more that you could look at. I have probably 7,000 albums or so. I've never been able to get rid of them.
I got rid of mine, and now I feel bad about it. Thanks.
Well, and so what Disc Revolt has become, too, with albums,
we've
had the band Manchester Orchestra, which is a very popular band from Atlanta. Those guys worked for us, by the way, in the beginning, in the early days. But they released an album with a pocket or sleeve in the cover, where they put the digital download card in too. So the fan got not only the album, but they got the digital form as well.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So, and we tell everybody, you know, what you can use Disc Revolt for to market is only limited by your imagination.
Yeah.
We have authors who have given away chapters of books.
Yeah.
We have churches who have given away, have done retreats and have given away the speakers.
Yeah.
So it's impressive stuff.
That's a cool idea. Yeah, when I was looking at it on the website, I was thinking, I was telling you before we got on the air that I have this book background. I used to own a bookstore. I'm friends with a lot of authors and do a whole author interview thing and whatever. And I was sort of thinking, oh, I wonder how we could make that work for them. That's a cool thing.
Yeah.
So because a lot of people also, I like the free chapter idea, because a lot of people don't want to invest in the whole book. You know,
right.
They go to hear an author speak and they want to contribute something. They want something. But just telling them to go look it up online, like you say, I think it says it on the website.
Mm.
If you can get people to retain that by the time they get home, it's a miracle, because that's just not how it works.
That's exactly right. And that's why the card was an important application. A lot of guys said, what do we need the card for? Well, you don't need the card. We can give you codes. You can attach it to whatever you want.
Right.
But give them something to take away so they have to refer to.
Well, and I like the idea of selling it, even if it's for a small price.
Right.
Because then people don't throw the card away. If you just hand them the card, it's another piece of junk they picked up along the way. But if they paid even a dollar for it, then they feel like, oh, I paid for this. I need to go use it.
We had, what was it called? Fiction Plane was the name of a band that toured with the Police. It was Sting's son's band.
Oh, cool.
And they got 1 million download cards from us. And
wow.
They gave them away as people walked in.
Yeah.
They gave them away.
Yeah.
And as people walked out, they walked through cards everywhere.
Right. Because they were free.
They were free.
That's the problem with free. All right. I don't want to take all our time up on this, because I know you're here to promote this golf tournament for Wellspring. So let's talk a little bit about Wellspring, which is a local Atlanta charity.
It is. Yeah.
And before we get too into it, tell me how you found them and how you got involved.
Well, what I haven't said about what I do now as a drummer.
Right.
Is I
know we skipped that whole thing.
I travel with a Christian artist named Laura Story, who just recently won a Grammy.
Excellent.
Yeah. First of all, she's an excellent writer and a wordsmith like no one I've ever worked with.
Wow.
And great person. So I know Laura through attending church at Perimeter Church in North Georgia, North Atlanta here.
Yeah.
And I meet with a group of guys on a regular basis through the church, and we said, you know, we meet, we have fun, we talk over, you know, life life's goals and stuff, and you know, we have a great time, but we need a service project. We need just something to do.
Yeah.
So I went to, or actually we went to, I don't think it was me, but I went to John Cleveland, and who was there, a friend of ours, and he said, I have just the opportunity for you. So he sent us to Peachtree City, where we went to a home called Wellspring Living that was set up to help young women who had made poor choices get themselves back on track and on the road
okay.
to success. And I'll tell you, it was an eye-opening afternoon for on many levels. But what it did for me, for all of us, was introduce us to a group of women who have such a passion for this, who just did this out of a project from their church.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've become my heroes. Mary Frances Bowley, who started this and is the director, has more energy than anybody I know. And I said to her last night, I just don't know when you sleep.
Yeah.
You know, she always looks good. She's always up in charge. And she's, you know, and she's gone through some adversity with her family. Her husband had cancer for a while. He's through that. And in the thick of all that, she was determined and very focused with Wellspring. So
when did Wellspring start?
In, I think it was 2001. I should grab my notes because I'm one of these guys who likes to quote facts and figures, and I'm always exaggerating.
Nice. Well, we'll just take that with a grain of salt then.
Yeah. So we're it was good. Established in 2001.
Yeah.
And it was just a group of gals who just went out on the street and found young women who were either on the street for drugs or for sex or were victims of battery, and gave them a safe place. And in that process, brought other people around to help them and nurture them, and then finally set up a program that is a multi-year program where they are isolated from the life that they were living and go through a series of education and health courses and get themselves back on track and graduate through the system. The system has a remarkable 84% success rate.
Yeah.
I mean, in anything, 84% is off the charts, but especially in something where you can easily fall off the wagon or go back to a life that may not be, you know, they may have felt comfort there for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
And getting out and being on your own and not being prepared could be scary, and you find yourself back there.
So it looked like on the website now there are a couple of different programs that they have,
yeah.
like specifically for girls a program and then for women separately.
Right. Well, what this did over the first, I'm not sure of how many we've been with, let's say 6 years, it was specifically for young women. But it was a natural segue to start becoming involved with young children who are being forced into sex slavery or sex trafficking.
Right.
I'm not sure you're aware of this because I don't think we posted on our site, but Atlanta is constantly either one, two, or three in the country.
That's terrible.
This problem.
Yeah.
And those are based on FBI statistics.
That's terrible.
And so naturally, I think someone came to us from the state and said, would your program be adaptable to children? And we said, absolutely. And so we actually partnered up with the state and with other organizations to create Wellspring Living for children, for young children. It's a different environment, obviously.
Yeah.
Because we protect everyone who's in it, but the level of protection for children is much greater.
Of course.
Prior to Wellspring being developed and establishing homes for these children, if they were taken from the streets, they were put in juvenile detention. So they went from the streets to jail.
Yeah.
And there was nowhere else for them.
Yeah.
So over the course of this time now, we've developed the program. We've had people from the United Nations come in.
Wow.
And talk to us about duplicating this program overseas, internationally. Mary Frances and her staff constantly train other people from cities, from other cities coming in to duplicate this program. And so it has become, for us, the nine guys who are part of this, just a passion. Now, the guys who are in this group, you got a musician here, right?
Yeah.
So I could drum up some business.
Uh-huh.
another drummer joke. One's an architect. The other is a commercial property developer.
Yeah.
The other guy's in insurance at a very high level. So these guys all had services or products or stuff that they could offer. And so we're sitting there talking about what we'd just seen and how actually blown away we were by all this. And I said, you know, at least we could do a golf tournament for them. And Mary Frances was walking by the room, and she looked back around the corner. And she says, when can we do this? And we, you know, it was at that point that I realized that I had just opened my mouth, and I don't know whether we were serious, but I had just committed everyone else in the room too.
Nice.
And so it was probably the next 4 to 5 months that Mary Frances was just relentless.
When's the golf tournament?
I want to get together and talk to you about this golf tournament. And God bless her. I mean, because, finally we just said, because I think we told her we'd do it within a year, or someone mentioned that. So it was about 3 months or a month and a half before this tournament, something outrageous like that to do a golf tournament. And we just opened up our Rolodexes, found our friends, made calls, and said, hey, we're having a golf tournament, you're playing. And so we filled it the first year.
Yeah.
And created a very high bar to achieve in the second year. This is our 7th year.
Okay.
And we've raised a significant amount of money. It's one of the biggest fundraisers we do, or that Wellspring does.
Yeah.
And it's this year, it's on the 16th of April.
Okay.
At St. Ives Country Club up north, a beautiful country club.
Okay.
And the weather is, I'm kind of torn by this early spring we've had, or early summer in some cases.
Yeah.
Because Atlanta is a transitional zone. Unless we get a couple of days of frost, people with allergies are really going to suffer.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Bermuda grass needs 80-degree weather to really green up. And I drove by the course today, and it is gorgeous.
Yeah.
So, it's a great day on the golf course.
So it's about 3 weeks away. Yeah,
about 3 weeks away. Okay. 3 or 4 weeks away.
Yeah.
It's a great golf course. It's a great day. We have, it has a lot of the traditional golf tournament elements to it. You know, hole-in-one cars and stuff like that we give away.
Yeah.
and everything that we've had sponsors come in and underwrite the tournament. So the cost of the tournament is almost paid for. So everything that we can bring in at this point goes right to the bottom line.
Awesome.
And supports the children's home. So because the girls' home is already on its own working very well, self-sustaining. But the children's home is something that we really, sex trafficking in children has become a cause celebre these days.
Yeah.
And the thing about it is that...
Well, you're kind of a celeb. So well, that's all right.
Yeah. But what it really involves rolling up your sleeves and getting into the middle of this thing and getting some things done.
Yeah.
Excuse me. It must be the pollen.
There you go. It is. Yeah. Worst ever.
And so, you can go to the Wellspring site, which is www.wellspringliving.org. And you will learn all about Wellspring to begin with, and it's a fascinating story. If you go to the second page, you go to the golf site, you can register for the golf tournament.
So you can still register.
You can still register. We're thinking about having a deadline because it's great to have deadlines to have our all of the necessities in line and not paying for things that we won't use, like food and beverage and stuff like that.
Sure,
but if someone wants to play 10 minutes before the event and
you'll
can make it up there, I will. If they need me, I'll drive the cart for them.
There you go.
So we'll get it done. Yep.
And what about sponsorships? Can people still sponsor?
They can still sponsor.
Okay.
We have sponsorship packages which give you signage and both in our program and on course, give you a foursome and some other things that.
So approximately how many people do you expect?
Well, we sold it out almost yearly.
Okay. So how much is sold out?
Well, if you're going to do a full course, it's 144 players, but we don't think that's a sellout. We think that is pain and drudgery. having 144 players on a golf course for a tournament like this is a day's event.
Yeah.
Shotgun is at 1 o'clock. We start, you get there at noon, hit balls and whatever. And so you can work in the morning if you want to, or just go out and, get blistered before you play. It's totally up to you. But we cut off about 122, and that's a comfortable round of golf for everybody. We do what's called a modified Texas scramble, which means everyone hits their own ball from the tee.
Okay.
Okay, you take the best ball, and then you play your own ball from that point forward, through the
hole.
That
keeps it moving?
Yeah, it keeps it moving. You're getting the advantage of playing a foursome or a scramble with the best guy who can hit the ball the farthest,
That works.
Everyone wants to play from that guy's position.
I would like that.
But from that point forward, it's your ball and your scores are tallied, and that's how it's worked.
Very cool. So again, it's April 16th?
16th, yeah.
Okay, very cool. And are you going to bring pictures of what you look like with the 70s hair to have on display there?
I might have to send them to you. Well, I may.
life-size.
If we get enough people from this program and they have think that is a request, I'll have to do
there
that.
There you go.
I might just go get a wig and show up with a drum set too.
that would be kind of awesome too. I love it. All right. So again, the website for Wellspring is?
www.wellspringliving.org.
Okay.
And I also might suggest this, that you go to www.laurastorymusic.com.
Yeah.
Listen .com and listen to Laura's story, her story.
Okay.
About how she wrote these songs, and then listen to the Grammy Award winning song.
Okay, so we have Wellspring
and Laura's story.
And Laura's story music and Disc Revolt.
Disc Revolt.
DiscRevolt.com.
That's
okay.
It. Yep.
Easy. So, and we'll have all this on the website too, so people can find you
Perfect.
If they want to. And I don't know, I still want to see the 70s
it's
hair.
It's a long but, list of people who are trying to find me, by the way.
I bet it is. You never know what you did back in the day.
That's true.
Someone is now hearing this and going, I knew he was out there still somewhere. Well, we really appreciate you coming on and
My
sharing
pleasure.
All this information. And I hope the golf tournament goes amazingly well and that you have, 70 more years of success with it. Neither you or I will be around to see that, but it can still happen. And of course, we'll be back next week with more great guests on Showbiz Atlanta. And thank you for listening and thank you for being here.